Funding for Think comes from SMU Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How did air travel become such a hassle when a generation ago it was the civilized upscale way to get where we wanted to go? U.S. airline regulators are inundated with more than 10,000 consumer complaints a year these days, to say nothing of all the kvetching we do on social media and by word of mouth. It's cramped, it's crowded, we're asked to pay extra for everything but cabin pressure, some flights arrive late, and some luggage never arrives at all. But we have to travel, right? And for many of us, flying remains the go-to option. So why did we get to this sorry state, and is there any way to make flying better without pricing ourselves out of the market? Aviation consultant Mark Gerchick is former chief counsel of the Federal Aviation Administration and author of the new book, Full Upright and Locked Position, Not So Comfortable Truths About Air Travel Today. Mark, welcome to Think.
Thank you, Chris. Glad to be here.
I think most of us understand why 9/11 changed security protocols at the airport. We don't like the hassle, but we get it. What does it have to do with all the other unpleasant changes we've seen in the past decade?
Well, part of it has to do with the fact that the airline industry in 2008 confronted an unbelievable burst in fuel costs. Basically, the cost of a gallon of fuel went from about a dollar in 2004 to about $4 in 2008. And fuel costs are the single most important component of airline expenses. And so basically the impact on the industry was just a sledgehammer. There was panic in the streets. And what happened was they really created a whole new set of thinking about how airlines go about their business. They found a new business model, and that business model isn't necessarily such a happy thing for consumers. Basically, it means that you need to fill that airplane almost 100% if you possibly can. You need to charge just up to the fare that passengers are willing to pay and not a penny less. And you need to cut back on service. And so we're experiencing a lot of that now. That's one reason it is not such a comfortable experience anymore.
And I was interested to read about the fuel surcharge, which is something we started to see when those fuel prices started to spike. It makes sense, I suppose, if they're unexpected, but some airlines have decided, let's just hang on to these.
Well, that's right. There's an expert in fuel who had a comment recently who said he can't see any relationship between fuel surcharges at all and the price of fuel. So, in effect, fuel surcharges are really just a way of increasing fares. And in the United States, you basically have to include the fuel surcharge in the total fare that you advertise to the consumer. You know, fuel surcharges started out, I think, in the early 2000s, I recall that British Airways, the first fuel surcharge they had was in 2004 when the price of fuel crossed the $1 mark, a dollar a gallon, and their fuel surcharge was, I think, $4. And now, of course, the fuel surcharges can be hundreds of dollars, and so this has become a huge element of fares, really.
On the other hand, your sense is that we passengers have gotten just a little bit paranoid that the industry is out to get us, when in reality they are just trying to stay in business. One of the ways they do that is by, as you mentioned earlier, packing us in as tight as possible, as many times a day as possible, some of which can contribute to delays.
Absolutely. Essentially, the airlines have figured out, look, efficiency and productivity are going to be the ways they're going to make money. And that means basically turning that airplane around as quickly as you possibly can. If you can, between a landing airplane, turning that around and getting that airplane to take off again on another revenue flight is sort of a key to maximizing the revenues. And what's happening now, I mean, Southwest was famous for this in the old days. They were able to, what they call, turn an airplane in 20 or 25 minutes. Takes a little bit longer now, but the faster you can get that plane turned around, the more likely it is you'll be able to add an entirely additional flight at the end of the day, and that's pure gravy. So you're right, that kind of emphasis on efficiency, on making it as productive as possible, getting every minute you can of flying time out of that airplane and your crew, that's really how they're stressing to make the money.
Of course, there's not much room then for error for, you know, a passenger who really does take longer to get on the plane. And after a while, that spirals into delays.
Absolutely. And there is a ripple effect of delays across the day. If you're flying in the morning, you're much less likely to experience a delay than if you are after that airplane has been turned around three or four or five times. And one delay sort of builds on the next, and by the time you're at the end of the day or the evening and it's rush hour and the weather's coming in, that's when you're going to take the delays.
Okay, so we often on particular carriers have to pay for our baggage these days. Is that really a better deal for us than charging everybody up front and sort of including that in the price of a ticket?
Well, you know, the airlines will tell you, look, it's a way of allocating the cost of carrying the bag to the people who bring the bags. And, you know, if you're not carrying a bag, well, you know, you shouldn't pay for it. On the other hand, there have been a number of kind of analyses done of this, and the cost to the airline of actually carrying the bag is probably a considerable amount less than what they're charging you. In other words, it's a profit generator. So, you know, it's more than just that you're paying for the airline fuel to carry that bag, and even for the labor costs. It's that they're also making money out of that, and the airlines are basically looking to take the concept, the quaint idea of a flight, and break it down and monetize every little piece of that they can. So, you know, you're going to pay for an extra 3 inches of leg room, and you're going to pay to get an assigned seat, and you're going to pay to get your reservation, and you're going to pay for your pillow and your blanket and your meals and everything else. And so basically they're saying, look, stop thinking about a flight. Let's start thinking about a kind of a whole bundle of services we're provided, and you can choose what you want.
Is it any cheaper to fly on a plane that is also carrying freight in the belly?
Well, almost all the aircraft do carry cargo, and that is a profitable business, especially in the domestic arena. So that's pretty typical. Aircraft almost always will carry a certain component of cargo, and it's a way that they basically cushion revenues.
Okay, so how much do the airlines say with those little check-in kiosks they have as compared with the cost of human beings helping us at the counter when we arrive?
You know, that whole issue of the kiosk is a kind of a double-edged sword, and I think about the kiosk as almost representative of a lot of kinds of sort of passenger automation issues, because what it does is basically the goal of the industry, and the international industry has said this recently, is to create almost a seamless transit from the time you step out of your car at the airport to the moment you're on that airplane, a transit in which you'll have almost no contact with a human being, that it's kind of a do-it-yourself flying system. So you go in, or in fact, even without the kiosk, you go online and you print out your boarding pass and you print out your baggage tag and you scan your ticket and you scan your identification, and you get on and you have an automated gate agent and you scan your iPhone at the screen there, and you walk on. And so, you know, that's going to cut costs tremendously. Labor is the second biggest expense to airlines, and they would like to, you know, human beings are expensive, and labor is expensive. The downside, of course, is that it further sort of dehumanizes and depersonalizes that whole experience. You know, folks go into airlines, into air travel, and they're stressed. It's a stressful experience, and, you know, you're going to not have that person looking at you and saying, you know, thanks and have a nice flight. Now, that might matter to some folks.
So labor is expensive, and of course, we know there are lots more people who work on the ground in various capacities than those who work in the air. But being, say, an airline pilot is no longer the first-class ticket to a wealthy lifestyle that it used to be.
Well, it isn't, you know, I know there are going to be a lot of people in the Dallas area who work with, you know, your fine airlines down there who have experienced these, you know, cuts in salary and cuts in benefits over the years, and they have been considerable. Of course, we've also lost something like 100,000 employees industry-wide over the last, since the 2000 period, so... Mm-hmm. There's been a lot of impact on labor and on particularly pilots. They have had they've suffered considerable drop in salaries. At the very top end, of course, you're still talking about a very healthy salary for very senior pilots. But on the other hand, entry level co-pilots on regional airlines are coming in at $20,000 a year. So it is not a ticket to easy money. That's for sure.
I like this, that airlines don't ever talk about lost bags. They call them mishandled, which is like such a wonderful euphemism. How often are bags mishandled?
That's on the theory that there's always hope.
Right. Exactly. It could be somewhere.
They're actually mishandled not very often. The industry's actually improved in this area. I think it's something like three out of, well, I don't want to give you an exact number. It's something like 3 out of 1,000 bags. So it's, and there are all kinds of statistical issues with that because not everybody, only about half the passengers carry bags and so forth and so on. But, and most bags, almost all bags eventually get back to you one way or the other. Not all, but close to all. But one of the reasons for the improvement, of course, is that fewer people are checking bags because they don't want to pay the checked bag fees. So they're carrying them onto the airplane. And of course, that's creating all those wonderful issues about the kind of the scrum about trying to get your bag into the overhead before the other guy gets his bag into the overhead. But there's a solution for that too. The airlines are willing to sell you the privilege of getting your bag on first by early boarding fees. So it's all a kind of an interconnected revenue process here.
All right, talk about the interconnection between those bargain bonus tickets we see advertised on like Orbitz and Travelocity and sometimes the airline's own sites and the people who are paying full fare. Maybe their company is paying for them to fly first class. Who is really paying to make that aircraft get in the air?
Yeah, that's a... It's a complicated question because basically what's happened is the airlines don't think of a seat on an airline as a single product. There are lots of different products at different fare levels on that airplane, even though each of those seats looks identical. So what's happening is, look, if you're willing to make your reservation and buy your ticket 6 weeks ahead of time, and you're willing to go on a Sunday morning at 6 a.m., and you're willing to take a no refund policy, so you have to use that ticket, and maybe you even have to stay over a weekend, you're going to be able to fly to Orlando for $99 or wherever it is. On the other hand, if you're the person who has a business meeting in Orlando day after tomorrow, and that just suddenly came up, and you need that last minute ticket, you're going to pay $499. So, and the airlines know that, and so what they're kind of try to do is sell the cheap tickets to the folks that are willing to take that risk and are willing to buy long in advance. And then there's a whole other product, which is that $499 business ticket for the business person that has to get there. So it's a very mixed bag. And in many ways, the front of the airplane, the business first class, and the people who are paying the full economy fares are contributing much more proportional revenue to that airline than the people in the back who are getting the deals.
And if I need to make a complaint, it's sort of instantly obvious to anybody who looks up my ticket which one I am, whether I paid full price or whether I got an incredibly bargain basement fare.
Well, they'll know within range. Yeah, they'll certainly know whether you paid full fare or first class or business class, obviously. But they will also know what kind of a they can look up your code, the fare code, and see whether you got a deep discounted ticket or not. And that does, of course, have an impact. I mean, you would imagine if you're thinking about wanting to cater most to your most lucrative sources of revenue, that's where you're going to put your best people and your quickest answering of the telephone and everything else.
Mark Gerchik is my guest. He's an aviation consultant and former chief counsel of the FAA. His new book is called Full Upright and Locked Position, Not So Comfortable Truths About Air Travel Today. We'll come back to the conversation in a couple of minutes. You can join us now by calling in to 1-800-933-5372 or by sending email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in global studies, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is aviation consultant Mark Gerchik. He is former chief counsel of the FAA and author of the new book, Full Upright and Locked Position, Not So Comfortable Truths About Air Travel Today. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or email think at kera.org. Mark, do we really need to get to the airport 2 or even 3 hours before our flight leaves?
Well, if you're an airport, they'd like you to be there. Then if you're an airline, they'd like you to be there. Then you're not going to miss their flight. And the airport, of course, it's called dwell time in the business. The more dwell time there is, the more chance you have to visit the airport concessions and the restaurants and so forth and so on. You know, the time involved in getting to the airport ahead of time, there's a cushion built in there, obviously, for uncertainty. And you know, what if there's a problem? What if there's a very slow line? What if there's a security issue that comes up at the airport? So, look, a lot of time is built in. You know, in my personal experience, if I had an elapsed passport and I were flying to Mongolia and in the middle of August out of Newark, I would probably get there 3 hours early. But other than that, you gotta kind of have to use your discretion, and especially if you're an experienced flyer.
Well, you know, it's interesting because here in Dallas, for example, a lot of people, I think, used to fly to places like Austin and Houston, and now, depending on how early you have to get there, it truly is faster to drive.
Absolutely, and there has been a significant decline in short-haul air travel. People have decided, look, I don't need the hassle, I don't need the time commitment, I can get in my car and do it. And so, or get on in the East Coast with a fast train between New York and Washington, it's the same thing. So that has definitely had an impact, and we have it's a more hassled situation, and it's also gotten pricier. That said, you know, we do have to remember, and I want to make sure we get this in, that it's a very safe system. I mean, we are the level of safety in this in the aviation, the U.S. aviation industry is quite remarkable. It's really a magnificent story.
So my mother-in-law is one of those double Xanax flyers. She gets very nervous. And I'm eager to share this book with her the next time I see her, because you do have a list of things we probably don't need to worry about. Number one is that the airplane is not going to break. Can you talk a little bit about maintenance and how it's done?
Sure. I think we start with the technology of the aircraft, and these are incredibly sophisticated machines. They're not perfect when they're introduced. We've seen that with the 787. There has been some issues, but they are. And most aircraft do have some what they call teething periods, but the aircraft are very, very heavily tested. To be certified by the FAA and to get to be certified as airworthy requires years and years of oversight and testing. And then, of course, the maintenance. Maintenance is also overseen by the FAA. It has about 4,500 safety inspectors. Not all of them do maintenance. Maintenance is an area where we need to look at some improvements, particularly in foreign repair station maintenance. But overall, the proof is in the pudding here. You'd have to fly literally, I think it's every single day for 63,000 years, according to an MIT professor, in order to be involved in a fatal accident on an airplane. Another great statistic that I like is that if you took any kid at random on the street, he or she is more likely to be president of the United States than you are to be involved in a fatal airplane accident.
Hmm. Okay, so another one is that turbulence does not cause plane crashes.
It doesn't, and it can cause injuries for people who are not strapped in, particularly flight attendants, in severe turbulence. But if you've got your seatbelt on, turbulence just does not have a history of causing air crashes. I think the last one was when an airplane flew into a tornado in Amsterdam or something about 30 years ago. So it just doesn't happen, and airplanes don't fly into tornadoes anymore.
And they can essentially they can see that weather coming because of technology.
Yes, yeah, extreme weather like that. This was actually at the end of a runway where the plane was, I believe, very low and it was just taking off. So that's not going to occur. And basically, you're not going to get routed through a mature thunderstorm or convective system like that. It's just very, very, very unlikely. And it's just not turbulence. It's just an issue that's frightening to everybody because we all go through it and it's unpleasant. But if you strap in, you're really going to be fine.
So before I give my mother-in-law the book, I will razor out the section where you say we maybe should worry a little about pilots and air traffic controllers falling asleep on the job.
Look, fatigue is definitely an issue. It's our difficulty in thinking about air travel is that we have human beings have a really tough time kind of assessing relative risk. If I tell you, look, you have a 1 in a million chance of something happening to you, you're going to say, God, I don't know if I want to take that. I mean, we just really have trouble getting our heads around the idea that there's a potential risk that something bad might happen, but it's so tiny that it's unrealistic to worry about. And so that's kind of at the core of some of the safety stuff. You know, the industry doesn't like to talk about safety at all. You rarely hear safety talked about in the airline industry, except in the sort of the broadest kinds of bromides about, you know, safety is our number one issue and so forth and so on. Because there's an idea that really passengers don't have the ability to handle the concept that, you know, it's not absolute.
I realize that details are still emerging. A lot hasn't been made public yet. But do you have any useful takeaways from the evidence that's been released so far about the Asiana crash earlier this month?
You know, I don't have anything really to add to this. As you say, it's still really speculative. And I've seen many times that the speculation about these air crashes tends to be wrong. There is, however, there's one issue that underlies a lot of the accidents that have occurred in the last 5 or 10 years. And this, I don't know if it applies to Asiana or not, but it's this issue about what happens in the cockpit. The phrase for it is cockpit resource management. That's the relationship between the pilots and the co-pilots and between the humans and the automation of the aircraft. And that's kind of a difficult issue. Are they coordinating well? Are they, is the co-pilot, if the co-pilot sees something wrong, is he or she, or usually he, willing to raise that forcefully with the pilot? Are people relying too much on the machine, on the automation, or are they, have they, you know, are they watching things as they should be? So these are the kinds of sophisticated issues involving safety now that are way beyond where we used to be 20 years ago. You know, will the machine break? The machine isn't going to break. The question is, are we operating it in the best way possible?
Is it reasonable to feel better about the relative safety of a U.S.-based crew and airline and plane than one that comes from overseas?
Yeah, it depends on where overseas. The safety record is better in the United States, just purely statistically, than it is in a number of other places. There's been an analysis of this where really the U.S. is more or less on a par with Western Europe and the most developed Asian countries, I believe, and those are better than the safety record there is better than with developing countries. And overall, the safety record is far better in the United States than it is in, say, Africa, where there are some real issues and challenges about air traffic control and technology issues. So, you know, I think probably the U.S. is the leader in this area.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. My guest is Mark Gerchick, whose new book is called Full Upright and Locked Position, Not So Comfortable Truths About Air Travel Today. Let's speak with Dave in Denton. Hello, Dave.
How are you guys today?
Great, thank you.
Chris, I want to tell you I love the show, and I listen to it every day at lunch.
Thanks.
My question is, I've been flying for a long time, and I've had a lot of experience dating back since OS to probably 1998. So I've seen the airline industry change a lot, but the one thing that I've never seen change, and if the equation is all about efficiency and getting planes turned over, why can't they load the back of the plane first with all the people that have, you know, extra baggage or extra luggage? You know, they're the ones that are going to take the most time, because the delay is caused when you're trying to load other people and everybody's still standing in the middle of the aisle trying to get their things in the overhead bin. Hmm. I'll make my answer over the air.
What do you think, Mark?
You know, loading airplanes is one of the great is really one of the great issues in the business. There have been innumerable studies of how do you most efficiently load an airplane, and I'm trying to recall. Airlines do it somewhat differently. Some people operate; they'll load from the window seat inward on the theory that, you know, again, it takes more time for people to get in. Others will go from the front to back, back to front. I think one of the studies said that what you really ought to do is load people by alternate row numbers. And I mean, it gets very complicated, but the idea is that everybody has enough room to put their luggage in the overheads. It's a good question, and, you know, I don't really have an answer. However, the caller does put his finger on something that is there's plenty written about if you're interested in.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also get to us via email to think@kera.org. In fact, Tom in Fort Worth had a question about maintenance outsourcing of airlines to Mexico and other developing countries to save money.
Mm-hmm.
What do you know about that, Mark?
Well, it is that's a concern, and recently it's been raised by the Inspector General, Department of Transportation, and others have raised a concern about is the FAA capable of or adequately overseeing foreign maintenance bases, and the AFL-CIO and others have raised this as a concern. Quite honestly, the pilots do not seem to have expressed a lot of concern about this, and they're flying. You know, they're obviously flying the airplanes. Foreign maintenance probably does vary considerably. There have been problems in Latin America. On the other hand, a lot of it is done in places like Germany and Hong Kong, which are considered very good. There are issues, particularly in the Latin American situation. I think, you know, it's important, again, look at the results, though. So far, you know, knock on wood, we haven't had any maintenance-related air crashes or maintenance-caused air crashes, as far as I'm aware of, since I think about 2003 when there was a turboprop crash, which I believe the maintenance actually occurred in Huntington, West Virginia. So, you know, it's an open question as to how much of the issue is economic and how much of it really does involve oversight. I do have to add, though, that the FAA, you know, the FAA resources are not unlimited, particularly in terms of their ability to oversee all these. And it's possible that we do need to have a greater emphasis on overseeing some of these maintenance bases, and not just abroad, but also in the United States.
So give us some perspective on this. About a year ago, I flew one of the ultra low cost carriers where the plane was kind of dirty. And it, you know how you go to a restaurant and you think if the bathroom is dirty, I'm worried about the state of the kitchen. That was my sense, you know, just being in the cabin. Should we not assume that they're cutting corners on maintenance if the flying experience is uncomfortable and sort of shabby?
Yeah, no, I wouldn't. I would draw a distinction between the safety oversight and what they're doing inside the cabin. No airline, I'm not aware of any situation where there's been an intentional cutting back of, you know, of resources for safety. Just as an economic matter, it wouldn't make any sense for an airline to suffer that kind of public relations disaster of having an accident because of that kind of an issue. So I don't, at least not in recent years have I heard of that. But I do agree with you that there is a there is a sense that the service on some of the ultra low cost deals is very trying, and it probably does add to the stress and so forth and so on. But I would not think that any large U.S. carrier is going to have a safety issue that's because of economic considerations.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak next with Brian in Dallas. Hey, Brian.
Hi. Good afternoon, Chris. I had a question about passengers and the FAA. And just to mention real quickly, my family is a big aviation family. My mom used to work for American Airlines until just recently. She retired a couple of months ago. My sister actually works now as a flight attendant for JetBlue. And I've always wondered, how does the FAA balance passengers' rights, what passengers should be getting the type of service they should be getting and allowing the airlines to operate freely as an independent business? How does FAA balance the two?
That's an excellent question. And I would just add, technically, it's actually the Department of Transportation, which is the parent agency, is the one responsible for the consumer side of the equation, for consumer rights. The FAA is devoted almost exclusively to the safety side. So, but they you know, the question still stands. If you have a deregulated airline industry, what's the role of the government in making sure that consumers get a fair deal? And that is a that's a core question. In my view, there's an active role for the government in regulating some of the consumer issues, particularly things like the transparency of fares. You know, there's a new rule out that says, look, passengers are entitled to know everything it's going to cost them, the mandatory costs, not if they want to buy a meal, but the cost of surcharges and so forth and so on. I think that's important. People are entitled to know that kind of issue. There are other consumer rules, like the famous one recently was about your right to get off an airplane. If you're stuck on a tarmac for 3 hours, shouldn't you be able to unload and leave that airplane? There have been huge fights. The industry's opposed a lot of these rules, and I think incorrectly, but they have. And so there is a role for government. On the other hand, deregulation of the airlines has allowed for fares to be kept very low. Well, not very low, but relatively low. Airfares are still a relative bargain to what they were before deregulation, and they've allowed lots and lots more Americans and people around the world to travel by air than ever would have been able to probably if we were still keeping fares up by government edict. So it's a mixed bag, but there's definitely a role for government in my view.
Mark Gerchik is with us. He's an aviation consultant and former chief counsel of the FAA. His new book is called Full Upright and Locked Position, Not So Comfortable Truths About Air Travel Today. You can be part of the conversation now by calling in to 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org. We'll be back in a couple of minutes.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in global studies, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is aviation consultant Mark Gerchik. He is former chief counsel of the FAA and author of the new book, Full Upright and Locked Position, Not So Comfortable Truths About Air Travel Today. Join us by emailing think@kera.org or call 1-800-933-5372. Mark, one thing that strikes me as funny is that we all did nothing but complain about airline food until they stopped presenting us with the cold, unpalatable meal, and now we are outraged that we don't have this to complain about anymore.
It's true, and it's probably as much a matter of trying to simplify the whole experience of the whole air travel business. Food adds a complication, not just an expense. It basically you have all kinds of issues about delivery and procurement and safety and health and safety and so forth. So basically, most of the air industry went the route of the low cost carriers, which was in the famous Southwest peanuts. That was the peanuts for dinner approach. That occurred really soon after 2001. As soon as that was possible, that's sort of what happened.
Are they saving a lot of money that way as well? Some airlines now will actually sell you food, which seems like maybe you could make a little bit of money that way.
Yeah, oh, you can make money. They are making money on sales of food. I think the cost of food, food it definitely is a something that's used for in the front end of the cabin of the airplane, business and first class. It's a competitive issue. The quality of the food, the luxuriousness of the food, and some of the international carriers is quite remarkable. And Singapore Airlines, for example, is the second largest purchaser of Dom Perignon champagne in the world.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We have Deborah on the line in McKinney. Hi, Deborah.
Hi. Hello.
Hi. Go right ahead, please.
Okay. Well, I'm not sure this is actually a pervasive problem in the industry, but I'm curious about it after I saw the movie Flight with Denzel Washington. Is that actually a viable option to turn the plane upside down when your hydraulics go out? I mean, just from I know how ridiculous.
I'm not a pilot, but I'll tell you, I have asked that same question. We all wonder that. I mean, gosh, I'm sitting there in the movie theater telling my wife, who gets nervous about these things, don't watch this part. But no, it's I'm told that that doesn't happen. On the other hand, there was the movie is apparently, as I understand it, taken some of the ideas taken from an incident that occurred, I believe, in the Northwest a number of years ago, where a jack screw, which is a kind of a screw on the back of the tail of the airplane, was not properly lubricated and forced the airline to invert, the airplane to invert. As I recall, that did not work out. But yeah, there's actually another issue in that movie that's of some interest, which is a question about pilots and intoxication and alcohol. And the FAA does random testing of pilots, lots of pilots every year. And I think, as I recall, the numbers are about 1 in 1,000 pilots show some indication of having alcohol levels over 0.4, which is about half the
driving limit,
driving
right
under the influence rate, mm-hmm. and that's the standard rate for the FAA. So it's not tolerated in the industry. I mean, if you're found to have intoxication, it's people don't wink and nod and go about their business. That's considered an absolute no-no.
Yeah, and you say in the book nobody would hesitate to turn in a pilot that they suspected, which is
absolutely
a comfort to us all. Can you talk about this? Is there an effective way to complain about a problem we've had with an airline, or should we just realize that we're going to have to suck it up until we get home?
Well, it depends on the problem. I mean, if it's an unpleasant flight attendant who's being brusque or snippy, you know, you're not going to get much anywhere with that. But if it's my seat was broken, or my in-flight entertainment system was broken, or I had a ticket, you know, for a flight and I wasn't given the proper seat that I had reserved, you should definitely complain, and you should write directly to the airline. You can also write to the federal government, to the Department of Transportation, but what they'll do is just pass that along to the airline and require them to respond in some way in 60 days. But, yeah, I think writing to the airline sometimes can be effective, just straightforward. Here's the problem. Show them what documentation you have, and you may get somewhere with it. I mean, it's a the airlines are trying not to have, you know, trying not to create problems which they don't need right now. They understand what's going on. They understand that the service is cut back, and they understand that their clients are not, that their customers aren't terribly happy. That said, they're focusing most of their effort on the most lucrative customers, which are the ones who are paying the most money.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go to Jennifer in Dallas. Hi, Jennifer.
Oh, hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Good afternoon, Mark.
Hi.
Chris, interesting show. I have a question that relates to baggage fees and efficiency. It seems to me that the airlines have it backwards in not charging for carry-ons. It just seems like, especially after 9/11, with all the sort of inspections we have to go through just to board the plane, they would want to minimize carry-ons, but instead, by charging for checked bags, they've sort of shaped people's behavior to carry on more bags, and it just seems like it would be fairer and more efficient. and safer, possibly, if the cost of your ticket included, as it used to, at least one checked bag, and there was a charge of some sort for carry-ons. Do you think there's any chance of that?
I think it's a good point. You're not the first person who's raised that. Some experts have talked about that as well. There actually are now some charges for carry-ons. Unfortunately, they're also the same people that are also charging for your check bag as well. So I know that Spirit, I believe, is charging to put your own carry-on in the overhead bin. I think Frontier has a charge. If you don't book on their website, they charge you up to $100 if you get to the airport and try to put your bag in the overhead bin and you don't book on their website. And there are one or two other airlines that are now charging for that. But the question really is, look, why charge for check bags and not generally for carry-ons? I think part of it is the history of it. The idea was that people understood the checking of a bag as somewhat more of a service, that they could perceive that as, okay, this is an extra. I don't have to take that bag. Most people felt, look, I've got to carry on something because I have to have a change of clothes or whatever. So I think historically that's where that idea came from. I think also you probably have to, it's probably a situation where they were looking at their business flyers who they didn't want to upset, and they said, we're not going to charge for, you know, somebody carrying on their briefcase or their portfolio or so forth. But it's a fair question. I don't think that's going to change in the near future.
To what extent do airlines have any flexibility to charge a different rate than their competitors for a flight from, like, Akron to Atlanta?
Very, very little flexibility in one sense. That is, the base fare for a particular sort of the base of economy fare all shows up on the internet, and we basically make our choices in the online environment. And basically, what happens is these systems will rank the flight choice in terms of cost. And so no airline wants to be out of step, even $5, with the basic cost that shows up on the internet when you go into your orbits or Travelocity or whatever. And of course, passengers are always looking for the lowest cost, even though passengers often say, no, we'll pay a little bit more. When we get to that screen, we kind of look for where's the bargain. Those fares are not going to change. What can change, though, is some of the restrictions and which fares are available. That is, one airline might make more low fares available on a particular route than another airline might make on that route. So if, you know, they may all be charging $200, but there may not be any $200 seats available on one airline where they are on the other. So you really, it's a question of going into that, into the system and trying to find an airline that's got a seat at a price you want.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak next on the phone with Artie in Keller. Hi, Artie.
Hi. Thank you very much for taking my call, first
sure.
of all, and I'm sorry if you hear any noise background. I'm driving.
Just be
but
careful.
I definitely wanted to ask your guest a very pertinent question, which does relate to me more than anyone else. So this is regarding weight discrimination, right? I mean, we always talk about how we are not supposed to discriminate weight. But I feel me and my kids, when we are buying three tickets, and because we are all skinny, we are being penalized, and I'm short, I'm getting penalized if I have an extra baggage, and between the three of us put together, we weigh 250 pounds, but that could be another person weighing 250 pounds, and I still get charged for baggage. I mean, what does the guest have to say for that? And even if you go for a haircut, they go by the length of your hair or...
Well, those are interesting questions that Artie raises. We hear the other side of it. People who might weigh more feel discriminated against. Artie feels like maybe why should she have to pay for extra weight that she's not carrying on her body?
Right. The correlation between weight and cost to the airline is really pretty loose. It's the airplane itself with its fuel probably weighs about eight times the weight of all the passengers and the luggage. So it's not really a question so much of just how much you weigh. That has some correlation how much fuel is being used, but even that is it's not a very big determinant. It's real estate as much as anything else, and labor. I mean, you've got a seat, and the amount of time and effort that the airline has to go in to accommodate you and to fly the airplane and so forth and so on. So it's not just weight. Weight, you know, there is an element of that, as you point out, Chris. There have been a number of circumstances. There are one or two airlines which are now talking about actually charging people more if they're very heavy. So far that hasn't taken off. There are all kinds of other legal issues involved with that. But, it's one element in cost to the airline, but probably not the biggest one.
How did airline bonus miles become this bizarre shadow currency system?
Well, they really are. Somebody referred to them as a second currency. And it's particularly curious because their value is infinitely malleable. That is, basically, the airline can say, what is that mile worth? They can require you to have more miles for a particular trip you want to take, or they can flood the market with more miles and whatever. So I think we all like the idea of getting something for free. And, you know, they're not free anymore, of course. The free trips are no longer really free because there are lots of fees associated with redeeming them and so forth. But it's something to give back. It's a sort of a rebate to give back to these very, very frequent flyers who spend half their lives up in the air. And it's a way of retaining these very, very valuable customers. Loyalty is a way of saying, look, we're going to put our thumb on the scales in terms of our airline, even if we fly the same route at the same time, maybe even charge you a little more, but you're going to fly on us because you've got that frequent flyer card.
Are we in a position as consumers to have any impact on the way we're treated, on the policies of airlines, or does it always sort of turn out? It feels like the airlines have the upper hand. I would wonder if they don't feel like consumers have the upper hand.
Well, you know, I view it as a kind of a spy versus spy kind of deal, especially when you're talking about fares. I mean, the consumer comes up with the Internet, which provides perfect transparency to find out, okay, who's got the lowest fare. But then the airlines come back and they say, well, you thought you knew what was going on, but we're going to add in fees, and that's going to sort of muddy the waters. And then we come back and they say, well, we're not going to do this and that. And the airlines come back and say, well, we're just going to cut the amount of seats we put in the air and cut capacity and thereby raise prices. So it's a dynamic kind of a system. I think that complaining does matter. Congress has gotten involved in some cases in asking the airlines to come in, and then they hold hearings about things like, why can't I get a seat next to my children? Why do I have to pay extra for that? There are issues like that. There are politics involved in things like the three-hour rule, the tarmac delay rule. These are people who sometimes just citizens who have gotten so upset, and the media has exposed certain excesses and outrages and so forth. And so I think I do believe that. Passengers. If you look at consumers, basically, generally, when consumers resisted the banks from charging for us to use our debit cards to take our own money out of our own accounts, the banks backed down. And so, in an age of social media, I think that the consumer does have some power to complain.
Aviation consultant Mark Gerchick is former chief counsel of the Federal Aviation Administration and author of the new book, Full Upright and Locked Position, Not So Comfortable Truths About Air Travel Today. Mark, it's been a great hour. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. It's really been my pleasure, Chris.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Christina Martinez helped us out on phones, and our podcast is produced by Christine McConnell. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can learn more about the show and download the podcast at kera.org/think. If you want to send a comment, question, or a suggestion, you can email it to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.